Hi, my name's Chas Newby. I used to play bass with the Beatles for a short time, and you're listening to Things We Said Today with Ken Michaels and Steve Marinucci.
Hello, hello, and welcome once again to a Beatles program, a weekly show that we call Things We Said Today. This is a show that centers on what's going on news-wise in the lives of the Beatles. I'm Ken Michaels, one of the co-hosts of the show. You know me best for a program that I host, a syndicated show called Every Little Thing, and I'm being joined by my co-host, Mr. Beatles Examiner, Steve Marinucci. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ken. Hello, everyone.
On today's show, we're going to tackle a subject that we did on our last show. And it's kind of interesting because so much has happened in the past week since we recorded our show on this very same topic. And it's getting kind of crazy out there. It has to do with the new release. It's a digital release on iTunes called The Beatles Bootleg Recordings 1963. And I thought to hopefully kind of make sense of this all, this mess, some people might think of it as a mess, we'd bring back Alan Kozin, who is a writer for the New York Times and is also the author of the brand new ebook called Got That Something, which is all about the song I Want to Hold Your Hand from the Beatles, its importance, and everything leading up to the release of that song. We welcome Alan Kozin to the show.
Hi, Ken. Hi, Steve. Hello, everybody.
So let's just talk about this release because from everything that we had heard, the reason why this came out was to protect the Beatles from copyright laws in which they would have lost the rights to release recordings from 50 years ago. And in order to protect the rights to issue them at any point in the future, they had to release them now. That's my understanding of this.
They would have had the right to release them at any time in the future, but if they had released them, they would have been released as public domain tracks, and anybody could have taken them a week after they released them and put out their own edition, and that's what they want to protect against, I think.
And that has actually already happened with Love Me Do. There have been a couple of releases, mainly in Europe, of Love Me Do and P.S. I Love You on releases that aren't affiliated with the Beatles. And so, and I think, and it looks like they're trying to put a stop to that, although they've been it's been really quiet. I mean, what's really been strange about this whole thing is there was no press release other than a description on iTunes that we were just discussing, and there was no advance alert other than the fact that, you know, that I found out about it a week ago, and you found, Alan, you found out about it, and we both wrote about it in advance, and the way it broke was just really strange. It's very unusual.
The impression that I get is that the Beatles really, well, when I say Beatles, I mean Paul, Ringo, Yoko, and Olivia, the four parties there. They don't really want this stuff out. They're doing it only so that, you know, they hold on to the rights of these recordings and can make money off of them.
I think that's true. I think they don't want it out, or they want to reserve the right to put them out in whatever manner they see fit in the future. But did you explain in your last show the way the European copyright law works?
Somewhat.
We haven't talked about that. That's kind of why we're I'm sorry. We did talk about that a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah,
but go ahead and explain it again.
Simple. Yeah. The thing is that until last November, the European copyright law basically said that for recordings, which are treated differently than literary works and things like that, but for recordings, a work is under copyright for 50 years. Then they amended the law within the last couple of years. They've been working on it actually for a few years, and it was finally passed, I think, about a year ago, and it's supposed to go into effect sometime in 2014. They now changed the rule and said, okay, anything from after 1962, 62 is the cutoff. I mean, something like Love Me Do, it was released, but it was 50 years. It's now out of copyright protection. But anything from 63 forward, it has been released, it now has 70 years of coverage from the time of release rather than 50. If it hasn't been released, the coverage is only 50 years from the time it was recorded. That's why we're seeing all of this stuff that was recorded in 1963 coming out before the change of the year, because those things will now fall into copyright protection. The interesting thing about it is that because there's a distinction between the unreleased and released stuff, both of which are now going to get, well, will get 70 years of copyright protection once they're released, but the things that were released yesterday on iTunes will have 70 years from 2013. So, you know, your outtakes from the Please Please Me album are protected for 70 years. The released takes from the Please Please Me album are only protected for 70 years from 1963, so they're only copyrighted for another 20 years. Isn't that weird? The outtakes will have greater copyright protection than the finished versions.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, one thing I don't understand here is that there's all these other recordings from 1963, other outtakes that the Beatles haven't released. So those wouldn't be protected then.
Exactly. And that, in fact, is something that I don't think any of the three of us understand, because it makes no sense whatsoever. There are, of course, the rest of the sessions from the With the Beatles album. There is the I Want to Hold Your Hand and This Boy session.
Mm-hmm.
There are maybe another 40 BBC tracks that haven't been put out either on air, live from the BBC, or this first batch of unreleased things. And, of course, there are, at least from 63, a handful of live things that haven't been included on, say, the anthology or other things which get them into copyright protection. So there's actually there's enough for, I don't know, how many more discs worth, and they will be, as you say, unprotected because they're not published.
The whole situation is just so strange. It's the fact that they went about this, you know, very quickly, and Somebody must have pushed the panic button over there, and, you know, I don't know.
Well, they waited until the last minute, and that's a strange thing, because, you know, a year ago we had the first of the Dylan sets that was put out specifically to address this issue. In fact, its subtitle was the copyright extension edition. They were very frank about it. They, like Apple, wouldn't talk on the record at the time, but off the record, they explained the whole situation, and they were very, you know, open. But so Apple has to have seen that. I mean, it was a very famous release. It got a lot of coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And they have lawyers, and they must have known that, you know, we're going to face this situation at the end of 2013. And, in fact, we're going to face this situation at the end of every single year. So why don't we put out a sensible package of unreleased stuff that will get the stuff into circulation? And, you know, maybe they plan that from here on out, but this year it really just looks like a rush job, and, you know, with no press release, no announcement, no physical release, it's just all very strange.
Well, there hasn't been a press release because I think that the Beatles, and when I say that I mean Apple, that they don't want this kind of thing to be something that's emphasized. It's not,
that's right.
It's not their core catalog. It's not something that really they've gotten behind, you know, fully as something that
right.
they're proud of as a new release. They're doing this because they feel they have to. But at the same time, I was also wondering, you know, you listen to these recordings, and we all three have, and there are some sonic upgrades here, which makes me wonder, you know, they must have cared somewhat about this. But at the same time, I'm also thinking, because there's so much BBC material, I'm wondering if any of these tracks were actually considered for on-air. And since they were trying to improve the sound of those tracks, maybe this is the leftover stuff that they were considering for that compilation. I don't know.
Yeah, that was my feeling, too. It's a funny thing. I have an editor at the Times who is very interested in the Beatles and Dylan and bootlegs and all of this stuff. And I gave him a copy of the material Actually, before it came up in the U.S., when we thought that it may not come up in the U.S., and when he originally looked at the track list when I wrote about it last week, he said, you know, who's going to want this? There are five She Loves You. There's all these outtakes of There's a Place and Misery, and I only someone like you would want this. And he took it home last night, and he came in this morning, and he said, you know, I started listening to it, and it was really great. So it's a very eccentric release, but I have a feeling that when people listen to it, they'll say, you know, this is actually pretty good. And, it's done well on the iTunes chart. It probably could do better if they had given it a broader release. But, you know, as you say, Ken, I think they didn't want this out. They don't want attention drawn to it. They just feel that they have to do it for legal reasons. And I do hope that, they think about it more carefully for 1964-5-6. Here's the big question, though. When they get up to 1969, and there are, 100-some-odd discs worth of Let It Be outtakes floating out there in bootleg land, what are they going to do about that?
Right.
And put all that stuff out?
Yeah, I mean, even now, I mean, I think it's more wishful thinking that there's going to be another release before the end of the year, which I honestly don't think is going to happen. But when you talk about 1964, you're looking at Hollywood Bowl, you're looking at, you know, some great stuff from 64.
Well, so, Hollywood Bowl should come out legitimately.
Well, I agree, yeah. But assuming that they don't, assuming something like that doesn't happen this year or next year.
Keep in mind that about half of the Hollywood Bowl, or maybe a third of the Hollywood Bowl recordings, actually are already protected by copyright, because they were released in 77.
Right, right, but the rest of it is not. And so, you know, you got that, and then you have the 65 Hollywood Bowl concert.
Shea,
you got Shea, too. The problem's going to get really compounded year to year. And we haven't discussed about the way things happened beginning, you know, on Monday, where, you know, it started showing up in Asia on Monday before, you know, the day before it was supposed to come out here. And Alan, we were talking about this before we started, and you were saying that, and somebody else mentioned this too, that it was actually over the dateline. It was actually Tuesday
there.
Mm-hmm.
I had thought it was Monday too, because when I got up at, I was about to go to work at 8 o'clock New York time, and I looked on a website that I frequent that has a lot of Australians and New Zealanders on it, and they were saying it's here, it's $15.99. This is what it is, and you know, they were pretty ecstatic about it, and I went to work, spent all day Monday checking on iTunes in case it was going to be released a day early here. Then, you know, went through the day, went to midnight and kept checking iTunes and, got up a few times during the night and checked iTunes. Got up at 8 o'clock in the got up at 6, actually, and checked again, and thought, okay, I better write a story about this, because my Australian friends are now saying that it's gone. It vanished from iTunes in Asia. I thought, okay, something is up, and maybe we're not even going to get it, you know?
That was a feeling I heard on Facebook Monday night. People got really frustrated and really nervous.
That's right.
That they weren't going to see it.
So I wrote a story about it, and I filed it before I left. Got a call from my editor at about 8:25 and said, well, you say that it was released Monday, but, you know, everything that I'm hearing is saying Tuesday. And I said, no, really, before I left the house at 8 o'clock on Monday, it was out in Australia. And he said, yes, but the time difference. You know, we're used to time differences like between San Francisco and New York and London. You know, you don't think of like it being a whole day ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So my editor said, okay, right now it is 2:35 a.m. on Wednesday in New Zealand, and it was like 8:35 in New York on Tuesday. And he said, so how do you feel about it now? What is it? What do you want to say? And I said, well, okay, in that case, I guess when I was reading about this at 8 o'clock in the morning New York time on Monday, it was really Tuesday in Australia and New Zealand. So I guess it wasn't really. We all thought of it as being released a day early. In fact, the way I wrote my piece was that it was a little bit like a solar eclipse. If you were on the wrong side of the world or weren't paying attention, you'd have missed it.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
supposedly it came out when it was supposed to, and whatever happened on Monday, as strange as it was, I guess, you know, I don't know. But you know, the other story I'm hearing is that it happened on time, and you know, because it was originally planned for Tuesday, and that's what it was supposed to do. And
that, you know, when I got up on Tuesday, mm-hmm. the messages from my friends in Australia were, it's gone. They have taken it down. So, I mean, that's the other reason. It's not all that we were just anticipating too much and freaked out. Stuff was going on that was up on iTunes in Asia for 8 hours and then vanished for another day.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, I was looking for it at midnight Eastern time, 9 o'clock California time, and it wasn't there. And I ended up going to bed that night saying, you know, I'll see what happens in the morning. Because it was not there when I went to bed that night.
Why don't you just bring your iPad to bed with you and you can check it every few hours?
There you go.
My general feeling about this whole thing is that the Beatles themselves didn't want this out, so all they had to do was release it, even if it's only out there for a few hours, and then they'd be covered.
Mm-hmm.
So then they pulled it off the market. But then you were telling me, Steve, that here in the United States, they released it on iTunes and they pulled it off again.
Right.
So what really struck me about this whole thing is that, and today, and we're recording this on December the 18th, you posted an article on Beatles Examiner that this is now the number one compilation or album on iTunes.
It's the number one. In fact, I was just looking at the updated charts while we were sitting here talking. It's still the number one rock album. It's the number six album overall. It was number four last night.
Yeah, but
it's
number
six overall.
I think the reason why it's that high is not just because it's the Beatles. It's because of this frenzy that was created, and I think that was
right.
done intentionally because people are panicking. How are we going to get this? And
mm-hmm.
if it's suddenly off iTunes, you know, the thought is you better grab it while it's on there. So you got a lot more people who are going to buy it initially instead of waiting a while.
Right. Right, awesome. Exactly.
How do you feel about that?
$40 instead of $15.99 Australian.
Except it's not $15.99 in Australia anymore. It's
not
60,
anymore, no. When it came back, it was $70, I think.
I think it's like $70 in Australia now. So that's pretty strange, too, that there's such a big price difference. And then there was you were talking about your friends in Australia. There was a newspaper article, the Herald Sun, complaining about the price. But the price
right.
difference, so...
Yeah. I mean, and that could have been why it was taken down after 8 hours. You know, there might have been some miscommunication or glitch about what it was supposed to be priced at.
Mm-hmm.
Although you wouldn't think it would have taken them as long to fix that as it apparently did. I mean, it was off for most of what was Tuesday for us.
Right.
So
you would also
yeah.
have thought that would have been settled on ahead of time, rather than waiting until the last minute like that. But the whole thing has been crazy. I mean, it's a very odd release. There's no promotion, no ads. So far, no ads.
And you can't get Apple or Universal to answer any questions.
Right. Exactly, yeah, because, I've been running into the same thing that you have. The only thing that we know is that despite what people were fearing initially that it was going to disappear, that apparently the indications are that it's not going to disappear, that it will be available. But for
yeah,
how long, we don't know.
The phrase that was used was the foreseeable future, and you know, who knows who can foresee what, but yeah,
right.
So it'll be there apparently for a while. It also is, by the way, I mean, partly because of the way it was handled, I think, it very quickly began to be traded around in bootleg circles.
Mm-hmm. Especially
during that time when it was down in Australia, you know, and it didn't look like it was going to be coming up here. People just began sending it around to their friends. I mean, which is, you know, in a way, a shame from Apple and Universal's point of view. I mean, if this had been done in a more organized way, there probably would have been less of that.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, right.
Well, you know, there's also that thought that this kind of thing caters to, as much as I hate to use the terminology, a hardcore fan. You take a look at something like On Air, which debuted at number 7 here in America on Billboard, and then it just completely tanked. You know, what makes you think that something like this, if it was packaged and promoted, would do any better than that, or even probably it would do less than that?
I think the bootleg thing has something to has an attraction for people, even if they aren't really they aren't really bootlegs now. But I mean, just to the term bootleg has kind of a has kind of an attraction for buyers. It's like putting it in a headline in the story that, you know, your eye is automatically attracted to that, and I think that has a little bit to do with it.
The thing is that I think it would have had an appeal if they didn't put it out like this. In other words, and except that, in, you know, what I'm going to say wouldn't have been practical because they had to have it out before the end of 2013. But what really would have made sense would have been if in, say, February, to celebrate the recording, the 50th anniversary of the recording of the Please Please Me album, they had put out a package that had that album in mono and stereo with the outtakes that they've just given us and maybe, you know, filled out with some more of them, maybe the relevant BBC performances, maybe some live recordings. You know, this is what you would actually have expected from Apple now that Jeff Jones is there, because when he was at Legacy, that was precisely the kind of thing he did.
Mm-hmm. Well, if they hadn't put the mono box out, I would say they might do that, but that doesn't seem likely to me. You honestly think something is going to happen come February?
I don't. I really don't. I think they're not organized enough for something like that to happen. But that's what should happen, really.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, I mean, and this idea has been around for a long time. I mean, I was once talking to Bruce Spicer about, I guess it was sometime before the 2009 remasters came out. And when there was talk of, you know, the fact that they were going to come out, he was saying, you know, what they really should do is put them out on Blu-ray, with all the outtakes and mono and stereo and that kind of thing. And, you know, all that kind of info could fit on one Blu-ray disc. But, of course, they didn't have that either.
And they still haven't done that. I keep hearing rumblings to that effect, but obviously nothing has happened yet. Let me switch the discussion a little bit, because you just kind of mentioned things coming out in February. You know, we've got the Capital Box that's coming out now. And that's kind of strange, too.
Yeah.
Why is that strange? I mean, it's perfect timing.
It is perfect timing. Well, the fact, number one, that it was kind of announced again in an offhanded way because the albums popped up on Amazon in England and Japan. And that's a little strange. And then we had the website that kind of announced it but didn't announce it. And then we had the box set, you know, announcement. And what's really weird is the mixes. And Alan, you were saying that the information that they gave out, and go ahead and explain it, came from a booklet in the set. Is that where that came from?
Yeah, there is all the information that you had printed in, on your second article about it, about the technical side of what's going to be done, is actually a page of the booklet that comes with it.
Okay.
Someone with a very quick eye and a very good, you know, stilling program. Watched, I think, the video. They flipped through the book and actually managed to isolate the page and reproduce the page. And it was precisely that same material. Yeah, what they're going to do is, for all of the tracks that were, from a certain point of view, including, I have to admit, mine, messed around by Dave Dexter, you know, had reverb slathered onto them, or were mono tracks made into fake stereo through a process that involved boosting. blasting the bass on one side and the treble on the other, and then putting a couple of microseconds delay between the two tracks to fool the ear into thinking it was hearing something different. Or the alternative, which is when they only had the stereo tracks but were putting out a mono album, they just did a fold down to mono.
Right.
So in those cases, you know, those aren't ideal, and the tracks with echo and reverb all over them aren't, I suppose, ideal, but the thing is they are what it was.
Right.
Now, Capitol, or Universal, but this actually, the press release had a Capitol logo, so I guess we can say Capitol.
Right.
It's put together a really beautiful box set. I mean, the covers, the fact that they come with the reproduction inner sleeves, the fact that Yesterday and Today has the trunk cover, which you can peel off and reveal the butcher cover, it's beautifully done. But the sound is not going to be the sound of the American albums, and there is a total of one reason that you would want to listen to the American albums, and that is to hear what people heard at that time in America. And with the new set, you won't hear that.
Well, that's
you
a
know,
shame.
What they are going to do is there are 10 or a dozen mixes that are specific to the American albums. Like, I mean, the most obvious one is probably I'm Looking Through You in mono with the false starts.
Right.
But there are some other times when Capitol was sent mixes a little earlier than Parlophone was going to release things in England, and new mixes were done in between the time it was sent to Capitol and the time Parlophone put it out. So the Capitol mixes are unique. Apparently they're keeping those. But in that case, you know, and the rest are going to be replaced with the 2009 remasters, either in actual mono or stereo without the reverb. We neglected to mention that point. So in that case, what they could do is put out this set with the covers or a nice booklet showing the covers front and back and the inner sleeves and the butcher cover, and put out a single disc with the 10 or so orphan U.S. mixes and let you make your own compilation using the British 2009 mixes. There's really no need for a 13-disc set.
Well, they haven't really said what they're going to do with the old Capitol album sets either.
They kind of have, but off the record. They are out of print now, and they are never coming back.
Which is really a shame, because
They
were, I mean, you were saying the only reason to listen to them is what Capitol did with them. But for those of us that grew up with these albums, I mean, it was years before I heard With the Beatles. I knew my first exposure to the Beatles was Meet the Beatles. And
right.
It was, you know, I didn't hear With the Beatles, even though I lived on the East Coast at the time and you know, some of the radio stations were playing some of that stuff. You know, I've never heard With the Beatles for it was years after. And I, as a matter of fact, my first Pepper album was the mono, and I didn't hear the stereo one for years. So
you're not alone
true,
there, Steve.
But you see, if you just get the U.S. sequence of Meet the Beatles, but using the British mixes, you're still not hearing Meet the Beatles.
No, I know that. I understand that.
That's my point.
Right, and if that experience is not part of the new box set, that's going to be tragic. It is.
The only reason I would even buy this box set is to hear the songs as I remember hearing them with those mixes. I mean, the packaging is nice. You know, I care about the packaging, but it's the music that matters the most to me. And I got to be honest with you, you know, I grew up on the American albums just like you guys did. But when the CDs came out in 1987, I got used to the way it was released in England, and I really haven't listened all that much to the American albums.
Meet the Beatles has never left my head.
But if I was going to listen to them now, I'd want to hear them with those mixes. And there are times, even still to this day, when I miss the reverb of I Feel Fine and She's a Woman.
Right.
You know, and even I Want to Hold Your Hand sounds very dry, you know. If you listen to I Want to Hold Your Hand the way it was released there, it's dry compared
to... I have to say, I mean, long before the 1987 CDs came out, I had been listening really just to the British albums. I mean, once I realized that those were the ones that, that they made and they sequenced and they mixed, I just put the U.S. albums aside and never listened to them again until the first two box sets came out in 2004, 2006. And when I put them on, I mean, I thought that I thought it was really kind of charming, you know. I loved listening to Meet the Beatles with that reverb and in that sequence. And I always really have felt that that Rubber Soul, the American Rubber Soul, is a really good album.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, starting an album with I've Just Seen a Face instead of burying that song on side two of Help is it just seems so natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's because we're used to it that way.
Well, no, it was a better lineup, really. I mean, that was one of the few instances where Capitol beat out Parlophone, you know, as far as what they did with those albums. I mean, the Beatles complained about it, but, you know, that's one of the times that, that they did something right.
Well, I think there's an argument to be made there. You know, it's just kind of like when you're comparing with the Beatles and Meet the Beatles, and some people would rather hear I Want to Hold Your Hand first, and some would rather hear It Won't Be Long first. And it, a lot of it is all just, you know, what you're used to and how you were brought up.
But, you know, Meet the Beatles has, apart from it has Tilda Was You, which is a cover, and it is the only cover on that album. Meet the Beatles is a completely Lennon-McCartney and, in one case, Harrison album. It showcases the Beatles as composers better than either With the Beatles or Please Please Me.
Mm-hmm.
That's very true. That's one instance where there's such a drastic difference in that regard. But in their first four British albums, three of the four had six covers on there, and that's
right.
What they were doing at the time. And I think they did great covers. Yeah, I think.
I wonder if Capitol took them off because they thought, who wants to hear British guys selling American music back to Americans?
Right.
I do wonder about
they
that.
They may not have even thought of that. You know,
yeah.
Right. Well, I'm hoping that there's a better explanation than what we've already had on that for those mixes. I'm crossing my fingers. Let's put it that way.
And then when you look at this, all these albums, is there really a need for the Beatles story to come out on CD?
There probably isn't a need for it, but I'm kind of glad to see it back. I don't think I'll listen to it again more than once, but maybe even less than once.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was a relic of the times.
Yeah.
And it also, by the way, it does have the little clip from the Hollywood Bowl in there.
That's true.
So,
that
you
gets
know,
that
but,
back into copyright.
Yeah. Really. True. But, this actually may have something to do with that. You know, that hasn't even been approached, but maybe having the albums out does have a little bit of something to do with that whole copyright thing, too. By the way, it should be mentioned that the copyright thing only has to do with Europe. In America,
right.
It's a totally different situation.
Yes, in America, copyright protection lasts for 3,000 years.
It's actually
Disney's original version of the bill.
Right. Yeah. But
it's now like the life of the for compositions is the life of the composer plus 95 years or something.
I thought it was only 95 years. Is it 95 plus? Is that right?
There is something like that. Yeah, life plus.
Okay.
But you know, I mean, when the Constitution, copyright actually goes back to the Constitution itself, and when it was first envisioned, the term was 15 years.
Right.
So
right.
You can see how far we've come.
Well, and see how far the music industry has lobbied to get things, you know, their way on this thing. You know, that's really what's happened. I'm not saying that it should be 15 years, but
and the film industry and others, you know, probably more the film industry and the music industry has been sort of swept along in it and you know, without complaint, obviously.
Right. Right.
But really, isn't it irrelevant at this point where the copyright laws are from because of the internet? Because anything could leak out over the internet. I mean, if something comes out that.
Something goes out of copyright in Europe, then someone could legitimately make an album in Europe and, you know, even if they import it here, in the country of origin, it's completely legal. So the company itself can't be gone after, only perhaps the importer.
Right.
Hmm. And also,
a family full of lawyers, I think this way.
And there are some recordings that came out in America that were different than the way they came out, you know, in the UK, like, you know, I'll Cry Instead, the longer version.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to be able to get that released on CD.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Well, all 10 or so of those songs. But you know what? In a way, they missed out on another two, because they didn't include Magical Mystery Tour in the 13-disc set.
Mm-hmm.
And Magical Mystery Tour has unique American mixes of both I Am the Walrus and the stereo mix of Strawberry Fields.
Right, and I forgot about those. I forgot about those, and somebody reminded me about that the other day. So, yeah, I mean, it never ends.
It does never end, you know. And really what they ought to do is they should consult with us before they put something out.
They really should. They definitely, most definitely should. We'll have to talk to him about that.
It's pretty obvious the Beatles, Paul and Ringo, don't even think about these things.
No. Well, Paul is claiming these days, and I don't actually believe him, but he claims that he can't remember which came first, Rubber Soul or Revolver.
Oh, no.
So, they don't really think about those kind of details.
Well,
that's pretty amazing. Well, I always remember in the Beatles anthology when George Harrison said that he thought Rubber Soul and Revolver were the same album.
Yeah, he
thought stylistically,
they were like bookends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think of Revolver and Pepper as being closer.
Do you really?
Yeah.
See, I've always thought of Rubber Soul and Revolver as the bookends, and the gulf goes from Revolver to Pepper, but that's me.
Really, because Rubber Soul is very acoustic,
mm-hmm.
not totally, but to a great degree. And Revolver is very electric and you know, backwards tapes and avant-garde and a lot more Indian influence, apart from just the little sitar melody in Norwegian Wood. It's now got actual Indian music. You go to Pepper, you've got more Indian music, more electronic and backwards stuff.
Yeah,
so those two to me seem similar in a way.
Yeah, and you're right. They do seem to go together. I don't know why.
I think musically and stylistically, I would agree. It's just production wise that Sgt. Pepper was so much more layered.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Revolver is a much leaner album production wise.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Let me ask Alan. Do you think we kind of covered it already, but do you think there's more coming in the near future?
Well, I've heard, as you have, these rumors about further volumes before the end of the year. I asked specifically some sources close to this if that was true, and I didn't get a yes or a no. The
mm-hmm.
question was simply ignored.
Well, I saw the rumor on the Hoffman Forum. And so that's why I don't put a whole lot of faith in it at all. But, you know, you never know. You never know what's going to happen these days. I mean, like I said, 2 weeks ago if you'd have told me this, or 3 weeks ago if you'd have told me this was going to happen this week, I'd have laughed. So, who knows?
Well, but keep in mind they do have the rest of that stuff that needs to have copyright protection.
That's the hang. That's the hang-up right there, is that they do have that dilemma in the works. And I don't know. We'll find out soon enough.
Well, the question is...
It's supposed to be Christmas Eve, which is a terrible day. I don't know why they would have picked that day.
The question for me is, are they going to release everything that's in the vaults every single year?
Seem to have done in the first batch is ignore anything that was a breakdown. So only complete takes, and that eliminates a certain amount of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think in any case it will be everything in the way a bootlegger would do it.
Right.
I really have no idea. I mean, we pretty much know what there is left over that they ought to release if they want it protected by copyright.
Right.
And whether they will, I guess we have a few weeks see. Well, about 2 weeks, really.
2 weeks, yeah. We don't have that long.
Yeah.
So we'll find out sooner or later.
It really would be nice if they did what Alan suggested, and let's just say for 1964 they put together a box set of some kind for A Hard Day's Night.
Mm-hmm.
Did a stereo and a mono, and then, you know, alternate takes and everything like that, and do the same thing with Beatles for Sale.
The interesting thing, though, that is if they did do the second release on Christmas Eve, how much would it be, and would people want to pay, especially if it's another $39.99 or whatever, will people want to pay that? And that could get, the reaction could get interesting then, because you're already asking people to buy that box set next year, and I heard people, and I saw people on Facebook grumbling Monday that they were going to cancel their Capitol box set pre-orders when the bootleg thing didn't come out. So I don't know. We'll be interesting to see.
Here's the thing, you know, I think they don't care whether we buy these so-called, you know, bootleg recording projects or not, and that's why they can charge whatever they want. If we're willing to pay for it, that's great, gravy for them. And if we're not willing to pay for it, well, they've succeeded in having it published, and therefore the stuff is under copyright protection.
Right.
So I don't think it matters to them either way. And, I mean, I can say that, you know, I'm going to get them. You know, it doesn't really matter what they're
charging. Yeah, I mean, I feel like you do, even though, you know, we probably all have. I mean, so much of the stuff has been out there before, but, yeah, you're right. So
the question.
I mean, besides, I mean, I've written, I wrote an article some years ago basically arguing that bootleggers are culture heroes, and because they're preserving material that might otherwise be destroyed and, you know, or otherwise has been lost. And one of the points that I made in that article is that anybody who collects this stuff seriously to want all these bootlegs would definitely buy it if it was legitimately released. So having written that and published it in the New York Times, I feel sort of honor-bound to actually buy anything.
There you go.
But my question to you, Alan, would be, all this time, I think that whenever there's a Beatle release of any kind, there's a lot of thought put behind it, usually, when it's a commercial release. And they want it to do well. They don't want anything that they release to be a flop. So should they really care about product that basically caters to the hardcore fan? And I know that, Steve, this is now in the, you know, number one rock album on iTunes, but will it have any staying power? You know, that really is what determines whether or not there's that much of a demand. You're basically catering to a hardcore fan who is going to buy everything instantly or relatively soon after the release, and then that's it. Should the Beatles just say, well, I don't really care, just let it go out there, it doesn't really matter? Or should they care about, you know, the quality of the recordings that go out there? I don't mean production-wise. I mean the material. Should everything just be the best product they could possibly release? Or should every, you know, or most outtakes be released, an unreleased material, even if it's below par? That's something
well,
that's been a question
really
for many years.
If they want to protect the copyrights.
Well, then that's, you know, that's the only reason why this is being done.
As far as I can see. I mean, why do you think it's just 1963?
Right. Well, I'm just saying this in general. There are fans
out
there.
In general, they should be doing a much better, more thoughtful job. I absolutely agree with you. But in this case, you see, I think we now have two tiers of Beatles releases, so starting with this. One is the stuff that they want to put out and that they want to be, you know, very beautifully produced and, you know, generally admired by record buyers. And then there is this stuff, which, you know, I'm sure they're happy if it's number one on iTunes, but they're only putting it out for a totally practical reason. They don't really want to, as you said earlier, and it's completely utilitarian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say they'll be there for the foreseeable future, but I kind of don't believe that. I mean, look at what Dylan did with his version of this. He put out a set last year and a set this year in a limited edition of 100 copies. Basically, everybody who wants them can get them from bootleg sites, and it's not a problem. And I asked someone at Sony last year if they cared about that, and they really didn't. You know, they actually kind of seem to agree with my theory that people who are into this as collectors will buy the official ones when they come out. So for now, they're, you know, they have copies of the bootlegs. That's fine.
Especially if there's a reason to, which apparently, which there is. I mean, there is a sonic upgrade on several of the tracks. So
definitely.
That's enough of an excuse for people to buy it.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying my argument here has been, and I've discussed this with Steve, that the Beatles themselves or Apple have never really cared about the hardcore fan.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they really don't care about
it. They feel that the hardcore fans are just some sort of fringe element, and I don't understand it, you know. I mean, I really feel that the BBC sets should have been a 12-disc set with everything available, sequenced chronologically with good notes, such as Kevin Howlett has already written but published separately as a book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that would have solved the copyright problem for them.
For
those, know,
yeah. Yeah, we were talking about, when we were talking about the on-air, I suggested that it would be great to have those. Because not only would it have solved the copyright problem, but the shows sound better sequenced, fully sequenced.
Yeah.
When you've heard them as whole shows, they sound a lot better and they're a lot more enjoyable than listening to little song excerpt, little songs, you know.
And they say hardcore fans, but, you know, look in the jazz world. You can find a huge box set of everything by Django Reinhardt. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can find humongous box sets of Miles Davis concerts that originally had been edited down to maybe a single LP. But here's the whole week's worth of concerts that were actually recorded. I have to think, much as I love Miles Davis and Django Reinhardt, I kind of have to think that there is a larger audience for unreleased Beatles stuff. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems they were somewhat bigger commercially.
So I
don't understand why they look at the hardcore fans as a fringe group, but Ken's right, they do.
Another example is Hank Williams, all those radio, the health and happiness shows that he did.
Right.
You know, you can buy, I don't know how many, I forget how many discs they are, but you can buy all of those and, you know, pay triple figures for all of that stuff. And it's,
well, and Elvis. There's the Elvis mm-hmm. Presley Follow That Dream series up to now, I believe, volume 129, most of them at least two-disc sets, with outtakes from just about every single session and movie session, you name it,
mm-hmm.
you know. That's an awful lot of material.
Yeah.
Right. There's got to be some demand, but it's all a question of, in the case of the Beatles, I think they've always cared about how well their albums do. Does it make the top 10? Does it make number one? I don't think they want to embarrass themselves by putting out something that becomes a flop in their
minds.
They've
always been a little conservative, though. At least they were when it came to putting things out. Because Elvis never had any problem, or the Elvis estate never had any problem with putting out single outtakes to a release of stuff that had already been released, and saying, here, there's a single track, we've never put this out before. And the Beatles have started to do that, but on occasion. But now they've kind of gone to the other extreme with this thing, with the bootleg release, you know. So,
you know, I was thinking, Alan, when you were on our show last, that you were talking about George Harrison and that he was, you know, one of the main reasons why Carnival of Light didn't come out, and that he didn't believe in anything that was, in his mind, overindulgent
right.
to be released. He probably would be dead set against this coming out.
Probably, but I wonder what he would feel about the copyright argument.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Remember that he was the one that argued against the Star Club stuff.
Right.
So,
which, by the way, is now in public domain.
Which, by the way, is now in public domain. Right. Right. And, in fact, I was looking at a release this morning that has some of that stuff on it. So, yep.
Yeah.
Bingo.
All right. Well, that kind of puts a wrap on this show. Alan, thanks so much for joining us. Again, your new book is called Got That Something. It's an e-book all about I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is a delightful read,
Yes, please buy Alan's book.
Thanks.
And, of course, you're welcome to come on anytime.
My pleasure.
Thank you again, Alan. You came, I should tell everybody, he came on somewhat short notice, but thank you for doing it. We appreciate it.
Well,
it's always fun.
Let's hope that by the time this show gets posted that there isn't anything, a new development this release.
Please.
You know, that's one thing.
Developments are fun.
Yeah, developments are fun, except when they happen between the time we tape and the time the show airs. But, yeah, they are.
If you listen to our show before this one, it sounds so dated now. You know, things can change on a dime when it comes to news on the Beatles. So
I know. That's right. But we love it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. So thanks again, Alan. And for things we said today, I'm Ken Michaels, thanking all of you for listening, and I'll see you next time.
And this is Steve Marinucci saying, go look at iTunes, and we'll see you next time.